tonight I hope to reveal a little bit of what those attacks can do and actually how they're being employed in real life. To give you a bit of an overview of what I'll be talking about this evening, first of all, we'll have a look at information operations. Now, I understand this may be a bit of a boring 10 to 15 minutes for most of you, but it's just an overview of what information operations are. You hear a lot of talk about information warfare. What is it really? How is it being used? How does it relate to actual attacks that are taking place on the internet? We'll have a look at some of the tactics that are used there, some cultural differences. What is information operations in the US? What is information operations in China, for example? And have a look at how they can be translated into real-life attacks on the internet. Then we'll look at one specific targeted attack that took place from somewhere in the beginning of 2005 and is actually still taking place today. We'll have a look at the issue space, so what is really happening, who are the parties involved, have an overview at the individual attacks as they took place, and finally I'll show you a bit of a link analysis of the different objects and subjects that are involved in the attack. You'll see more about that later. And then finally, we'll have a very brief look at how to defend against these dark arts. What are the technical controls we can put in place? And finally, there's one thing that I really think is not really a solution, but a good approach to dealing with these incidents, and that's security intelligence. And I'll give you a bit more insight into that. And then we'll have some time for Q&A. Just 2 minutes about myself, or hopefully much less. My name is Maarten van Orenbeek. I come here from Belgium, and during the day I'm a security consultant. In the evenings and when I have time off, I enjoy looking into things that most companies look at as being residual risk. So the things that they take into account that can happen, but they mainly consider it out of their control and they insure against it, for example. But this is really what this talk will be about. So I hope you enjoy the next hour. Usually I like to give a bit of an informal presentation so that you can interrupt me and everything, but since I have way too many slides, I have to admit this. I propose that we keep questions till the end, and at that point in time, I'll definitely make time for questions. And if there are still questions after that, then just come to me. I'm here for the full 4 days, so you can always bother me. To give a very quick introduction into information operations does require a bit of a start in what is information and how is it being used. And I always like to compare this compare the past with the village and the future and today with the city. Just because in 2007, or as of 2007, more than 50% of the world's population now lives in cities. So that means that there's been a big cultural change over the last couple of hundred years, and it's very important also from an information perspective. When you look at the village, or rather what the village meant, in a village you generally have very fixed roles. You have people living there that have jobs that are actually fairly common. Every village, for example, has its baker, every village has its butcher. You have different types of jobs in every village, but generally they're the same. Also, between villages, you just have the little roads that you can take by car, but they're not really very common ways or very good ways of transporting a lot of information. So the village was really a place where we had all these people doing jobs that were very well known, and the content of the jobs was pretty much common. Like every bakery did sort of the same thing. They made some small changes, but nothing really radical because there was a baker in every village. Today, however, we moved to something completely different. We moved to the city. And in the city, you have very strong communication links. In this picture, you can see the ocean. The ocean was, in human history, one of the biggest ways of actually getting things across. For example, when all of Japan was actually blocked off from foreigners, the Dutch were still able to get to Japan and trade with them due to their experience in shipping and trade overseas. Information in a city has very unpredictable properties. You have a lot of people in cities that do the same job, but they have very unique selling propositions. Everyone does something for a different reason, and everyone has different specialties. So the value of information really depends on time, on the situation, on the people involved. Now, another very important piece of information operations, really a ground rule, is that reality does not exist. Reality is constructed. Every one of you has a very different view of what is happening here today. You've seen the same talks, but still you have different ideas of those talks. Some of you may like this talk, some of you may absolutely hate it. And that's really the same for everything. And that's because we really construct reality based on a couple of ground rules. And that was very well described by John Boyd, which was an Air Force officer in the US, who discovered something or wrote up something, what he calls the OODA loop. And it's based on what a pilot does when he gets into his airplane. He observes what is happening. He orients himself based on what he sees. During orientation, he looks at his own cultural tradition, at new information that he gets in, on what he achieved in life, what he has done, what he feels proud of. Then he makes a hypothesis of what is happening. He decides what he's going to do, and he takes action. And when he's taken action, he goes back to the beginning, he observes what is happening, and he can change what he's doing. So information is very important in how we construct reality and what we do. Now, the problem with this OODA loop is that it also very, very well signifies what can be attacked when you construct reality, when you think about reality. You can do three things. You can deny certain pieces of information, you can deceive people by feeding them information, which is incorrect, and you can destroy pieces of information that are important. And by doing each one of those things, you can actually make very important changes into how they perceive reality and how they make decisions. And that's really what all these new social engineering attacks that we're seeing today are dealing with. Banking Trojans, for example. A lot of banking Trojans actually get installed by being run through a user that is persuaded to click on an attachment, for example, because it relates to a news item. So this image, this OODA loop by John Boyd, which I blatantly stole here from Patrick Edwin Moran, I didn't draw this myself, this OODA loop very well signifies what can go wrong in the decision-making process and how people can abuse it. And this is very important in information operations, because what you're trying to do there is you're trying to make to have people make decisions that you want them to make, even though they may not be in the subject's best interest. So what is information operations really? In the US, they have a very nice definition for it. This comes from the Joint Doctrine for Information Operations. They call it the integrated employment of the core capabilities of electronic warfare, computer network operations, psychological operations, military deception and operations security, with specified supporting and related capabilities to influence automated decision-making while protecting our own. Now, that takes a bit of effort to just say, but it is a very good definition of what it should be. However, when you talk to American military personnel on information operations, they mainly focus on computer network operations. And computer network operations is what we perceive as, for example, hacking or even protecting our own information. The goal of information operations is to achieve an information advantage. So you want to have better information than your competitor, and you can do that by protecting your own information or by attacking the information of the other party, and you can do that by denying, deceiving, and destroying all these nice goodies. A main interest in the US for the moment in information operations is in coordinating execution. In 2006, I believe, there was a declassified information operations roadmap in the US, and that one really focuses on coordination, because the US is one of those countries where you actually have a lot of different militaries. You have the Army, you have the Air Force, you have the Navy, and all of those need to be coordinated. And of course, there's a lot of quarreling between the different groups on who should be doing what and what is really important in the big picture. How do other countries deal with it? A good example is China. In China, in the beginning of the 90s, there were a lot of different definitions on information warfare. A lot of them were copied from the US definitions. There were also a lot of them that were grown from the country itself. But one thing that has popped up in the more limited set of definitions that exists today is that most do not deal with victory. In essence, Chinese military doctrine is not interested with victory. They're interested with control. They want to control what the other party is doing to ensure that decision-making is in their advantage. Also, these definitions usually take into account people's war, which is a concept really thought out by Mao Zedong, and the concept actually deals with making sure that your enemy is attracted to you, so that instead of fighting somewhere else, you fight internally, but you make sure that your population actually supports your cause, so that the population is able to help you in actually protecting the country. And that's also very visible in some of the Chinese definitions today. And then very interesting are the stratagems. The stratagems are really tools of deception that have been devised over 300 years ago, and they're still, well, I wouldn't say in use, but they're still very well studied in Chinese military today. There are about 36 stratagems, and they're really very short sentences that describe a certain type of deception paradigm. For example, this is one of them, deceive the sky to cross the ocean. Deceiving the sky to cross the ocean means that you want to make sure that whomever is looking sees something that looks completely benign, let's say an email. And at the same time, you can cross the ocean and you can do whatever you want, but from above, it looks very normal and it doesn't look like an attack. These deception devices are really quite interesting. You can find all of them on the internet. There are 36 sentences that really describe unique pieces of deception, and I really love them because if you read the US doctrines on information operations, they really say this is the procedure to go about doing deception, and then it starts describing what is necessary to think about when you're doing deception. But none of them are really as clever as these 36 stratagems, so if you ever have time, look them up. It really is a pleasant read. So that's really it for information operations, but the reason why I wanted to give you that 5-minute introduction is because it really links into the rest of this presentation quite well. In this presentation, we'll look at targeted attacks, and targeted attacks usually have as goal to gain access to information, information that is valuable to you, that you can use to gain an information advantage from your competitor, and that's why the previous description really links in very well to what we'll be looking at right now. Of course, if you're doing a targeted attack, you need a methodology to do so. And most attack methodologies today seem to be modeled something like this, really. First of all, you identify the data that you're interested in gathering. So suppose that you want to have information on someone's whereabouts. You might want to have a look at his email to find out whether he has any schedule for that day, or you might want to look at his calendar. So you identify what information is valuable. In some cases, this may be, for example, where you have a group of people that work together in a forum on the internet that exchange information there. You can easily see on those forums who is really meaningful, who has good ideas, who is coming up with all the new stuff that everyone else follows. And so you can really identify who is important on a forum or a web portal and who has the information that you might be interested in. So you look for concentrations of information that you're interested in. You go to the forums, you go to web portals, you look for companies that are interesting. Then you look for those subjects of influence that really pull those companies together or pull that information together and make it useful. You can do that by crawling the website. You can do it by talking to people. Last week, there was even some talk about this Russian bot that was able to fake a human being so that it could actually gain some information from people, which is really quite a novel concept. You can also get it through social networking. A lot of times you can get useful information from things like LinkedIn and all of these other social networks. You can gather information on who has certain data, because generally people who know something about a subject, they really want to brag about it a little bit, or at least they share it with other people because they think it, because of course it's interesting for the other people to learn about that subject. So that's really how you can identify those people that are interesting from your perspective. And then one trick that you can use is send a contextually valid message. What do I mean with a contextually valid message? If I go back 2 slides or a couple of more, actually, you can see that you orient yourself based on information you already have. So if I send you a message and that message originates from someone you are linked to on LinkedIn, for example, then it's pretty common that you would accept that message as being valid. And I could put something in there that sounds usual for that person, and I could possibly convince you to take certain actions. So that's really what I mean with a contextually valid message. So this is a sample of the methodology that is today commonly used for these targeted attacks. If you read the documentation that is now widely available on the US Defense Department compromises that recently happened, because there have been a couple of public hearings on it, you can hear that most of these attacks took place by an attacker, in this case my favorite little beast, the demon, who compromises a server, then sends an email to the victim. The victim opens the email. Essentially, at that time, he opens an attachment. That code executes. The code connects to another compromised server, and then that compromised server is able to access data. Now, I know this is a very easy and simple representation of what is happening, and that in reality, it's a little bit more complex, but this is really very common to what happens today. In some cases, this is more complex because the victim is, for example, based in a company and you need to take into account proxy servers or you need to take into account other controls. We'll have a look at that a little bit later. This is somewhat of an explanation of what these attachments usually consist of. Most of the times in the recent past, these attachments have been exploiting certain application file parsing vulnerabilities. Why file parsing vulnerabilities? Well, the time that you could send someone an attachment and it would auto-execute because they were running a really old version of Outlook Express, those times are really gone. That just doesn't happen anymore. You can still send people executables, but most companies actually filter executables, or at least should filter executables, because for one or the other reason, every time one of these XA email worms breaks loose, there's still a lot of people that get infected, which is a bit difficult to believe, but it still happens. So a new thing really is we all have to run application software on our machines. We run Microsoft Word, we run Ichitaro, which is a Japanese word processor. We run, for example, an archiving utility such as WinRAR, and we need to do something with files when we get them. So, for example, someone sends a Word document to me, I double-click on the Word document, Microsoft Word actually opens it, but we all know that no application is really completely foolproof. All applications have some security vulnerabilities, and especially with the recent rise in techniques such as fuzzing, these vulnerabilities are relatively commonly found. And there have been a lot of instances in which there were stack or heap overflows in Microsoft Word, PowerPoint, Excel, Ichitaro, WinRAR, and many other applications, which could be exploited to actually execute code on a system. So generally, these files then consist of something to actually trigger the vulnerability and exploit it, then some shell code that takes action, that takes control over the system upon execution. And then generally, these files, because they are pretty large, a Word document, when you get a Word document of 500-600 KB, you're not really very suspicious, because it happens quite often. Word documents contain images. Those images are also included in the total file size, because in the end, a Word document is really just an OLLI container that can contain a lot of different other objects. So it doesn't really hurt if we put an executable into that Word document and we use the shell code to actually extract that executable, run it on the system. So in essence, you have a couple of components. You have the little piece of string actually that exploits a vulnerability. You have the shell code that takes action or control over the system. And then you have an executable, which is in fact the Trojan. There are also some other methodologies in which there isn't really an executable embedded, but just shellcode that connects to a remote server, downloads an executable, and then runs it. That exists as well, but that mainly happens when you have files that are generally smaller and when you would get, for example, a 1 MB HTML file. That's a bit suspicious, isn't it? Now, in 2005, it actually broke loose, this piece of news. The NISCC, which has in the meanwhile been renamed to CPNI, Critical Center for the Protection of National Infrastructure in the UK, and in the US, US CERT, they both released warnings which really warned of targeted Trojan email attacks. At the time, this mentioned that the attacker's aim appears to be covert gathering and transmitting of commercially or economically valuable information. The US CERT bulletin was really a carbon copy of the NISCC bulletin. It was also mirrored by the Canadian organization responsible for information security and also by DSD in Australia, for example. So this really gave an impression there's something happening here and we need to be careful. Now, I'm going to introduce one target today. I know when you read the description of the talk, you may have thought, oh, finally we're going to find out who broke into to Merkel's home computer, but unfortunately that will not be for today's talk, maybe next year. Today we'll be looking at another target, a target that we can use a little bit more openly because it's actually fairly known that they've been attacked, but the details haven't been known up until today. And this target is the Falun Gong. Now, could I see some hands here from everyone who knows what the Falun Gong is? Okay, so that's about 50% of the room. That's better than I expected. The Falun Gong is really a system of mind and body cultivation that was actually started in China by Li Hongzhi. My apologies for the Chinese pronunciation. I know that it's worthless, but It was started in 1992, and it consists of 5 sets of meditation exercises, which are commonly referred to as Falun Gong, and then also in addition as sets of religious teachings, which are commonly referred to as Falun Dafa. Now, this movement, the religious movement really, around it is now also commonly referred to as Falun Gong, so the terminology is a little bit used, intermingledly. This organization has really been repressed by the People's Republic of China dating back to 1999. And the reason for this is because at that point in time, a couple of weeks before this happened, an article appeared in a Chinese magazine, which I believe is called Reader's Youth. And this magazine article actually said that practicing Qigong, which is really where Falun Gong comes from, sort of breathing exercises and physical exercises, that Qigong, or the execution of Qigong, wasn't really very useful for youth and health development of youth. So, and the article also had a very critical tone of the Falun Gong movement and said that it actually wasn't useful and that it really didn't have much use. So at that point in time, there was some mild protest from the Falun Gong community, after which a couple of people were arrested. And then shortly after that, this happened. The Falun Gong actually managed to get many, many thousands of people to protest in front of the Chinese government headquarters in 1999. And this actually caused the Falun Gong to be banned by the People's Republic of China. The reasons that they named were because it was supposedly a threat to social and political stability of the country, and afterwards they really detained thousands of individual practitioners. Now, ever since that ban by the People's Republic of China has been heavily criticized by human rights activists, and also, which is a little bit in the sidelines, there's also been somewhat of an information war going on between China and the Falun Gong. To just name one example, in 2002, some Falun Gong practitioners from Taiwan supposedly were able to actually hack the uplink of the Sinosat satellite in the Chinese television satellite, and they were able to interrupt television programming and actually send their own television programming to the satellite, which could then be received in most of China. Now, this was a bit of a problem for China. Afterwards, they even launched Sinosat-2, which is the second satellite, and that actually had protection against this type of satellite hijacking. But that's not everything. In the sidelines, there's also been reports dating back to 2003 by Falun Gong practitioners that they received email viruses. And that was a bit interesting. So early this year, I decided to look into that a little bit more and got in touch with some of these people, got some samples of malware. And these actually very much interlink with what we've been hearing of the targeted attacks that have been reported from other organizations. Once again, there's nothing known really about the source of these samples, but it's just an interesting fact that it's been happening there as well. Now, from April to October 2007, there was a total of 26 total incidents, into which I'll go into a little bit more depth later. So this is really the Falun Gong. This in 1999, just before they were banned, all the people lining up in really what was a relatively peaceful protest in front of the Chinese government headquarters. Now, it actually all started in 2005 with screensaver objects. Now, I don't know whether you remember this, but a couple of years ago, it was really common to send a virus mimicked as a screensaver. And the reason for this is because a Windows screensaver, what we know as .scr files, are in fact executables. They just have a different extension, and you can load them as screensavers. But in fact, they're just executables. And this was actually one of the first attacks that I received a copy of, and it was an executable that was called .scr, and it was attached to an email. And when you opened it, you saw something like this, and it continuously moved around, and other things happened on the screen. Fairly benign texts, mostly. Now, if you look in the file, you can see that it's just a program. You can see that DOS stub executable there. Just to give a small introduction, when you load an executable on Windows, most executables actually contain a stub executable at front. The reason for this is so that if you run it on older versions or on command line, then you use a different loader for the executable, and then it just shows you that the program cannot be run in DOS mode. Now, at the time, they weren't really very inventive in choosing host names for their control service, because at the time, the host name was just faluninfo.3322.org. Which was kind of funny if you're trying to do a below the the below the ocean targeted attack, isn't it? That piece of code then connected to a machine on port 80, and that machine was actually granted full access to the compromised host in the return connection. So the host actually made an outbound connection, and that connection was then used. The remote server could connect to the infected machine and then execute code. Now, one thing that was very interesting and became obvious also at that time was something that I've come to call domain parking. Now, I haven't seen this described anywhere else, so I don't know whether there's a better term for it. But it sounds a little bit like parking because it's used when you compromise a machine to temporarily shut down the attack and afterwards restart it when you need further information. The thing really is that these types of attacks, they do a DNS lookup first. So in this case, the code does a DNS lookup for file and info.3322.org, and then it gets back an IP address, and it then builds a connection to that IP address. Now, the problem with this attack is that once the hostname resolves and the outbound connections take place, you can see this in your firewall logs. So it's a bit of a noisy attack, and once it's running, you can easily identify which machines have been infected if you know the host name by looking at your firewall logs or if you know the IP address. So one technique that became common was actually to change the response at the points in time where collection wasn't really necessary. So suppose you need information, then you resolve the IP address. If you don't need information, then you resolve it too. Anyone who knows the answer? Localhost, 127.0.0.1. Because in that case, you don't have the outbound connection, and you only have the DNS query. And could I see some hands here of everyone who logs every single DNS query in this company? Nothing? I tried doing it once for a very small company, but when the name server crashed, when the log file was 2 gigabytes and I didn't turn up rotation, I just turned it off. But anyway, localhost is indeed an IP address. If you resolve to this, then the connection will actually go to the loopback interface, and in essence, nothing will happen. So this was a technique that they could use to temporarily stop the attack and reactivate it later. So the advantage was you could infect a couple of people by infecting their machines, and then afterwards the machines, when you needed information from them, you resolved the IP address, the machines connected back to you, and you could get information when you wanted. And in the meanwhile, it was very difficult to discover this, especially if you take into account that these emails were usually only sent to 10, 15, 20 people, and not much more. So then you know it won't get to an antivirus vendor. Now, there are two ways to identifying parking after the facts have occurred, because this was a bit of a problem for me. I had these samples that were dating back to 2005 and 2006, but how could I identify whether they were ever parked, whether the control service changed? Well, there are really two ways to do this. One way actually looks at the future, that's DNS Watch. DNS Watch is a really nice script that was written by someone whose name unfortunately slips my mind, but look on Google for DNS Watch. And what the script actually does, it just does a DNS lookup every 10 minutes and it registers when a host name has changed IP address. This is actually from an ongoing attack which is still taking place today, so this is an actual host name. And you can see on the 21st, 23rd, and 24th of December, when you see a plus, it means that the hostname is now resolving to that IP address, and a minus means that it's no longer resolving to that IP address. Now, it's interesting to know that the malicious code in this case has a check in it that checks whether the DNS lookup resolves or returns 63.64.63.64. When it resolves to this IP address, the hostname resolves to this, then it stops doing everything and it just ceases its operations, and the only thing it still does is a DNS lookup every 45 minutes. So you can see here that on the 21st of December, at 3:59, actually the attack was turned off, so it was resolving to the parking IP address. And then a couple of hours later, 13:35, it started resolving again to an IP address, which is based, I believe this is in Taiwan, but don't take my word on it. So you can see that in a couple of days' time, really, this attack was turned off, turned on, turned off, turned on. And so I'm hoping if this continues after today, which I kind of doubt since it's up here right now, but if it would continue, we would probably be able to learn something about the time zones in which these attacks are enabled and are disabled. So, but this is really a future thing. So if I enable this today for an IP address or a host name, then in a couple of days, I have a bit of an overview of exactly what is happening with that IP address. However, you can also go in the past, and this is actually where the cool stuff comes in. There are a couple of organizations that do something which is called passive DNS replication. There's one university here in Germany doing it. There are universities in Asia Pacific doing it, in New Zealand. What they do is they actually log all DNS queries. They don't look at who makes a DNS query. They just look at what is happening from the external DNS service to the internet. So they look at what is being resolved. And by doing that, they can actually build a good map of which IP address was resolving at which time, or which hostname was resolving at which time to which IP address. So using passive DNS replication, you can get a good insight in what has happened with an IP address in the past. The only limitation is you can only get information on when exactly a DNS lookup took place. So if nobody's resolving that IP address, then it's virtually useless. At that point in time, you don't have any information. So those are really two ways to track these domains when they take place in an attack. Now, this screensaver object, this was sent through somewhere in 2005 or early 2006, maybe. Now, when I ran this through VirusTotal, which is a tool on the internet where you can just send a file and it then runs 32 antivirus scanners over it, I got this result. So you can see that less than 50% of all the virus scanners were actually detecting something, and most of them actually had a generic signature for the Bifrost family of Trojans. So this was most likely not distributed to most antivirus scanners because most of them didn't really know anything about it. Then in 2006, something very interesting happened. There was another document that was sent through, which was called hujintao.doc. Now, this document, when you opened it in certain Word versions, this happened. Now, when you see this, it's generally not a very good sign that something is happening. So you can choose to recover your work, but in the essence, you were just trying to open this file name, so it wouldn't really help. But what was happening in the background when this actually was shown on the screen? At the same time, this document actually exploited a vulnerability in Microsoft Word, MS-05035, which allows arbitrary code execution on the machine. And at the same time, it connects to a server that was based in the US at the time. And what was interesting about this was that the code was distributed in April of 2006. And after more than 1 year in 2007, that host was still active and was listening on the port that was used for the command and control server. So this was really interesting. Now, using some connections and people, I finally got this host shut down, and there was actually a forensic investigation done on this machine. And what turned out, there was actually just a port forwarder running on it. So that port was being forwarded to another machine. In this case, it was based on ChinaNet, but probably, once again, another compromised machine. Now, the Trojan that was actually used in this... Sorry? ChinaNet is mainland China, so it's really the Chinese main ISP. In Taiwan, you have a couple of other ISPs as well, but in China, it's mainly ChinaNet. Now, the Trojan that was used in this case was called W32/Riler.j, which gave the remote host access to this compromised system. It gave the ability to drop new files on the system, create new files, and search the file system for strings, which can always be interesting. The Riler family, should be noted, was also listed in the NICC bulletin that was published in 2005, which was kind of interesting. Now, I had a look at the backdoor, and this was actually what it was causing on the network. So what you see in gray here is actually what was returned by the control server. What you see in black was what the compromised machine was sending to the control server. Now, what was very interesting, I kind of was interested because this machine was based in the US. And I saw that it logged something 0508_log.txt, and I started wondering, 0508, what can this mean? And then suddenly it jumped to me. It's August. It's actually the 5th of August. That's interesting, isn't it? 0508 on the 5th of August. So what I started doing, I started running this connection a couple of times to this remote server at different points of time. So I ran it in Eastern time, US Eastern time, where the machine was located, and nothing really happened. So the date just stayed the same. And then I started running it in a Chinese time zone. And I noticed that the date actually switched on a Chinese time zone. So the remote machine was actually, I thought its time zone was set to China, but then afterwards it turned out that it was actually just a port forwarder sending data to China. So the remote server was actually based in China. But it was interesting because they were trying to hide away behind a US machine, while in fact that didn't really have anything much to do with it. The rest, what you can see here from the connection, doesn't really mean anything. The wake was just to keep the backdoor alive, and no real commands were submitted. I had it running for a couple of days, nothing really happened, turned it off. Now, I did do a little bit of reverse engineering on the backdoor, and I found some interesting commands in it. So this is the full command set of the Ryler variant that was used in this specific attack. And there were a couple of interesting commands, like moon and disk. They gave access to certain files on the file system. Dead, when the remote site sent dead, then the backdoor just killed itself. It remained active, so on a reboot, it would have been reactivated. But at that point in time, it was killed. And then like actually gave the remote host a remote command 32 shell, so he actually gained access over the network straight onto the local file system running on the username of the person that actually opened the Word document, which, if you think about it, if you're looking for information like email, really is sufficient. Now, hujintao.doc was, as I said, submitted or received somewhere in 2006. And when I ran this true virus total in 2007, then this was actually the result. 9 antivirus scanners out of 32 identified the Word file as being malicious. And when I then extracted the embedded binary, it turned out that 15 of them detected the embedded executable. Now, most of them actually detected it because the binary was packed, and they just flagged everything packed as potentially malicious. So that shows that the Word file was probably never really submitted to any of these antivirus vendors. Now, just for clarity, I do have to add one little thing. VirusTotal does file-based scanning. So that means if you have an antivirus that does, for example, intrusion prevention using table hooking and API hooking, for example, it would probably have caught this. But file-based scanning definitely didn't. Then in April 2007, something else quite interesting happened. This email was received, or actually an email was received that contained an HTML attachment. So it didn't contain a Word document, just an HTML. And that HTML, when you open it, looked like this. So it was a petition to urge the Chinese regime to respect human rights in the true Olympic spirit. What was interesting was that this was actually a real-life petition. It exists. It was also distributed in a very benign email. But this one actually contained something else. Because if you looked at the code that was included in the HTML file, you saw some things that you would think are a bit out of the ordinary. So actually that much out of the ordinary that if I was an antivirus company, I would probably write a signature to trigger on everything that says evil object, because to be honest, evil object doesn't really sound very nice. But in essence, the email didn't really have much of a problem except for this. The message was sent from Taiwan, but was actually routed to an Australian mail service. Now, if you look a little bit further into this file, then you can see that it actually contains some interesting code. And if you decode that code, it was really just hexadecimal, then you gain this. So it actually tries to download an executable from a remote site. And that executable turned out to be a Protox backdoor application. Quite funny. Antivirus detection doesn't look very good. I think that evil object signature would actually be a good idea. But as you can see, nobody really triggered on it. And as such, most people also don't consider an HTML attachment as very suspicious. We're all used to drive-by exploits in the browser. We're used to going to websites and then having our antivirus pop up and saying, OK, this contains a JavaScript exploit for 802.db, for example, or some other Internet Explorer problem. But in this case, it was attached to an email, which is actually fairly uncommon. There aren't that many viruses that distribute as an HTML attachment to an email. Then in 2007, a lot of fun things happened, a lot of attacks. In May, there was a Word exploit, and it went on and on and on. Now, what was interesting about these Word exploits was that they were actually a little bit more complicated. So they actually started containing executables that were packed using PE/Armor or FSG, which are two very common packers for files to actually make them more difficult to scan and reverse engineer. FSG is relatively easy to unpack. PE/Armor is quite difficult. And also, very interesting, they contained a clean document with context. So that means that if you opened the document, Word crashed, but it immediately opened a new document, which was completely clean and didn't give any problem. At the same time, there were also some existing memes, as they're commonly called, that were starting to be reused within the community. So with a meme, I mean, on a lot of forums, you have these documents being pasted with all these funny pictures, for example, often very specific to that community. And they actually started to be reused, but then with added malicious code. Funny thing was that the new files actually contained a space at the end. So most likely the guy creating the documents had the original document on the same folder on his disk and just edited it and used a new file name. Now, it didn't only affect Word. There were also some exploits for WinRAR. And this is interesting because Word and Office generally auto-update. When you have Office, it informs you that there's an update and it installs the update. WinRAR, for example, as an archiving utility, doesn't do it. Now, in this case also, this WinRAR exploit only executed on traditional Chinese systems, which gave some funny results if you sent the file to, for example, Russian antivirus companies, because they then sent these anonymous confessions like, this case is not about infection by a virus, but about the crash of one particular program version on an incorrect file. Now, I really don't want to laugh at these people because they do a marvelous job, but in this case, it was a very, very difficult, a very difficult exploit to look at, so I can imagine that something like this happens. And then in 2007, the attacks just continue, a malicious PowerPoint, malicious WAR, malicious PowerPoint, and then just 5 Word exploits in 1 week, each connecting to different host names that then resolve to the same IP address. Also in September, another JavaScript dropper connecting to the same machine as the one from April. In October, there was actually a zero-day exploit that was used. This was the MS07060, which is fairly recent. And the exploit was actually distributed 6 hours before the patch was released. And this was also visible because the exploit was very rudimentary. You can see here what it contained. It did disable antivirus, did disable a certain host IPS solution, and it wasn't really covered by most antivirus software. But the interesting and funny thing is that it was actually based on a Visual C Hello World application. So my guess is, but I can't really collaborate this, is that they got their hands on the exploit a couple of hours before the patch would be released. They got everything together. They opened Visual Studio, opened the Hello World application, added the exploit, added a couple of reused code from a previous exploit, put it all in one file, and then just quickly sent it out, and giving the Hello World here. But the thing that this stresses is that it only has to be good enough to work. It doesn't have to be very complex. If it's good enough, then that's fine. Then in the autumn of this year, it just continued, a malicious Excel document, a RAR exploit, 3 more PowerPoint exploits, all very targeted. The emails were, for example, documents that contained a list of things that still needed to be done for a rally for human rights, for example. And then very recently, we've been seeing a new type of methodology that's in use, and that's really just information gathering tools. Instead of implementing a backdoor, what these tools do is they run on your system, they steal all your passwords for accounts that you have configured in Outlook Express, they steal passwords that you have configured for Hotmail, Gmail, all these other services, and then they submit them to 3 different machines, in this case 2 web servers in Taiwan and then to a Chinese email address. So this is something new, which really started happening over the last couple of months, really. Some quick statistics. This is really an overview of the exploits that have been seen in this specific targeted attack series, so mainly Microsoft Word, but also a couple of other ones. Also, the attacks per month, how they took place. Then the one thing that is very difficult with these types of attacks is actually to identify the threat agents. So with threat agents, I mean the people that are actually conducting the attack. So who is behind this? It's very difficult. There are a couple of groups that are known to use this, such as the Network Crack Program Hacker Group in China. A company in the US has a very good analysis of this online. Titan Rain was the incident that involved the US Department of Defense, similar attack again. And so it's really, really difficult to attribute this to a specific attacker because control servers can be shared, exploit code can be shared across groups, and really motive and techniques become the discriminators. And now I was really impressed this year with the Congress that there were so many ladies actually here, so I don't really want to discourage them. But one thing that people taught me when I was young was that one thing that makes history are maps and chaps. And so the thing you need to do is you need to build a map of these attacks to try and identify which machines are involved. On this map, you can see the different parking addresses. These are right in the middle here. You can see some of the other hosts. I have to admit I removed some IP addresses here because I wouldn't want them to be shut down tomorrow by some strange coincidence. So this is really an overview of what has happened over the last couple of months. It's not complete, but it sort of draws a picture of how complex these attacks can become. Now, how do we defend against this? This is really just a very short introduction to some techniques that you can use. You can build a wall, but we know that that worked in the city when you had a road and you had to approach the wall. But nowadays, when you have the ocean, walls really don't make much sense anymore. 2 minutes. Oh, wonderful. Now we'll have to hurry up. So first of all, antivirus. As you've seen, antivirus really isn't the most effective approach. But what you do need to think about is when you deploy antivirus, that antivirus is actually a very complex technology. People think we deploy antivirus and all of our problems are solved. But that's really not the case. You have to think about how antivirus deals with, for example, packed binaries, how they deal with new malware. Look at retrospective tests as they occur. Sandboxing has very limited value because sandboxing generally wants to see how a certain specimen behaves in a certain environment. The problem is your sandbox is never as complex as your real life environment and never as complete unless it's, and if it is, it's way too slow. Host IPS generally is a good approach, but it carries a lot of false positives with them. Software hardening is one solution. You can control the various software assets that you have. For example, if your users are using WinRAR, you might have a problem getting them patched because WinRAR doesn't patch automatically when a vulnerability is found. For Office, Microsoft released some great tools called MoEyes, which actually convert from older Office formats to the new ones, which really protects you quite well against these types of attacks. Network security monitoring DNS, for example, monitoring which host names resolve to 127.0.0.1 is generally quite interesting. Build awareness, identify communications that require trust, so people emailing each other, do they need to be certain that it's from this person, and start thinking about making them trustworthy, certificates and such. And then very important, and I'm going to take 2 minutes for this one, is security intelligence. The problem with these attacks is that they happen, and generally, when they happen, the attacker has all the time in the world to get something to work with your specific environment. This isn't reducing the noise floor. Generally, in security, we're reducing the noise floor. We're trying to limit the amount of infections. We're trying to limit the amount of issues that occur. In this case, we really need to be careful about the people that actually want to attack us, so who might be interested in our data. And what are the techniques that they use to access our data? So learn about their methodology, learn what they might use. In the US, for example, there are some great things that are called ISAC, Information Sharing and Analysis Centers. And these are really groups of companies that work in the same area, so really the same business line. And they share information on the attacks that have happened. And by sharing this information, when one company is attacked, then it distributes this information to the other companies, and they can protect themselves as well. In Europe, we've got a pretty bad reputation in this. In the UK, they've got something called WARPs, which are also analysis and reporting centers. But most of Western Europe actually doesn't really have these right now. And as I also showed, having some insight into the threat agent, looking at what is happening in these attacks, could be very useful in actually better protecting your organization. So that actually concludes everything I had. So I think we still have some time for questions and answers.
First, thank you, Martin. Now, if anyone has any questions, please wait for me with the microphone for the benefit of the people who are with us remotely. So, the first question.
Hi, okay. I assume most of these targeted attacks currently have the goal of information gathering. Mm-hmm. And I want to go back a little bit to the definitions you had at the beginning of information operations. So you also mentioned psychological operations influencing the decision-making process. Yeah. Do you see a trend in these attacks also having the goal of manipulating data or planting data, information to influence decisions, or is this more a means to an end currently? And what would you recommend how to adjust security controls to address this kind of threat?
Okay, it's a very broad question, but the issue I've mainly been experiencing is that you don't really get a lot of information about what they are trying to do. So you can see that, for example, in one case, they actually try to access an email box. In other cases, one thing that really clarifies where the attacks are going to is the switch from backdoors to actually just gathering credentials to email accounts. So for the moment, what I've been seeing is really focused on gaining information. It's not focused on changing data. So far, there has not been any indication that it's moving in that direction. Given the definition given at the beginning, it is a possibility. It's something that we need to take into account. But for now, it looks like it's based on gathering information to use that information to then do more items, but of course, or do more activities that would actually place them at an advantage. But that's difficult to measure for the moment, of course. And regarding the controls, I think you can implement a lot of controls to reduce the noise floor. You can implement controls by thinking, as I said, about antivirus, for example. Most of these attacks use packed executables, and you've got a lot of antiviruses that, for example, block packed executables. And this is a problem if you do it on the desktops, because there are some executables that are part of really complex software packages that are also packed to prevent reverse engineering. But in most cases on the email side, for example, you can generally relatively safely block these attacks because people generally don't exchange software through email or shouldn't be exchanging software through email. So those are really the types of controls that you should be looking at based on really what is happening out there. And second, of course, exchanging information is very critical. So if you know about one of these attacks, for example, exchanging the information that you have about it might be a difficult thing to do for some commercial companies, but it is one thing that does help. And I think governments also need to do their part there by actually introducing these types of information sharing mechanisms to actually protect the companies that that actually are based in their territory, to put it that way.
Okay, it would be nice if people who are leaving would postpone talking till they're outside. I think we have time for one little tiny question.
No more questions?
Well, you can talk to Martin for the rest of the Congress. So let's thank him again for this wonderful talk.
Thank you. And as I said, you can always email me as well. So either talk to me here at the Congress, I'm here. And otherwise, just send me an email and I'd be more than happy to reply.